Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Summer is officially here, and as many people depart on long-delayed travel plans, of course, a central part of travel is tasting the foods of a destination. And my guest today has written a book that samples the regional flavors of food that constitute America and those foods that reflect the diversity and ideals of the American melting pot. In his book, Food Americana, Emmy-winning television producer David Page shares how Americans have created a national cuisine from the cultures that make us up. Pizza, barbecue, burgers, bagels, American-Mexican, sushi, seafood, fried chicken, and more. Much of the foods he explores comes from his long work as creator of the Food Network's Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, a program that has turned local restaurants into national destinations. In Food Americana, Page attends a pizza school dedicated to making old-school Neapolitan pies in San Francisco. He attends the Memphis in May barbecue competition with a national contending barbecue team. He watches a lobster boat bringing in the day's catch in Maine and visits the National Buffalo Chicken Wing Festival in New York. Along the way, he shares a few recipes and celebrates the regional differences in our foods around the country, something he worries is slowly disappearing. David Page was an international news producer for NBC and later ABC, then a producer on Good Morning America, where he began producing food segments. He then created his own production company and created the Food Network hit Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. His new book is titled Food Americana, The Remarkable People and Incredible Stories Behind America's Favorite Dishes. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. David Page, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Your book, Food Americana, seems like about as good a way as any to spend the pandemic. It seems like a good part of this last year and a half, you were talking to restaurateurs and people in the food industry about what constitute American food. And what shows up in your book is the fact that a lot of what we would call, quote, ethnic food is actually American food.
Has become American food. What we did to create a cuisine of our own was take bits and pieces from other countries and other cultures' cuisines and modify them to our taste or to the availability of ingredients, and then eat them with such regularity that they are completely an American food.
And your role as being the creator of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, you've been part of this movement that is turn people onto regional food of, you know, local restaurants making a local specialty. But one of the things that you point out in the book is that these foods that start out as a local phenomenon pretty soon just travel across the country. We really have this knack of homogenizing whatever is good in a certain locale, and we move it all across the country.
Yeah, and that does raise questions among some people, foodies, I guess, and certainly food writers, about whether or not regional foods should be leaving their regions. It's a kind of a nostalgia thing that you used to look forward to going someplace specifically because of a food you could only get there. Now, you can get a pretty good lobster roll in Utah. You can get Memphis barbecue in Chicago. And I guess overall, that's good as long as they're made well. But there is that mystique from my youth when we would take summer vacation in Maine of eating my lobster on the wharf where it had presumably been pulled in just a few hours ago.
Well, what do you think we lose from that experience, not having that experience?
Well, the food experience is more than just the food. It's the environment in which you enjoy the food. It's interaction with people from that region who grew up with that food. And it's probably also the perfection of that food. As good as freezing and processing procedures are today, lobster that was in the water where it was swimming just a few hours ago is going to taste better than lobster that's been processed and shipped. Now, I'm not one of these aggravated purists who says, you shouldn't do that. I think, all in all, it's good that we are moving various regional foods to other parts of the country. But the part of me that is looking back on this through rose-colored glasses kind of wishes the nostalgia factor wasn't being eradicated.
Now, what was the story you wanted to tell with this book, Food Americana? You get into lots of stories about everything from pizza, Mexican cuisine, barbecue, sushi, burgers, fried chicken, lox and bagels, seafood, and you sort of go through these various sections, but what is the overall story you're wanting to tell about the people you meet and the stories you tell about each food?
Well, the first thing I wanted to do was wake people up to something that is such an integral part of their lives about which they don't do a whole lot of thinking, which is not a criticism, it's just a reality. I have been so involved in various kinds of American food over the years that even before researching the book, I had accumulated some knowledge that was probably not generally held. And I just thought, hey, if you're going to eat it, you ought to know about it. I also, not to get political, but at a time when America is tearing itself apart on the issue of immigration, I thought it was important to point out that that's where virtually all of our food has come from.
Yeah, even if it's an all-American burger, it might be made in a kitchen full of immigrants.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, the restaurant industry relies overwhelmingly on immigrant help in the kitchen, most of it from Mexico or Central or South America. But beyond that, the simple fact that pretty much everything we like came from someplace else, I think is an important thing to remind people. As is the fact that what we've done to those cuisines in modifying them to be Americanized is not a bad thing. I'm always struck by complaints of, quote, foodies, unquote, that the food at this Chinese-American restaurant isn't authentic. Well, it sure as heck is authentic Chinese-American food. Is it the food as eaten in the various regions of China today? For the most part, no. But define authenticity. Every food way evolves to the point where when people are complaining that their Chinese food isn't authentic, I might point out to them that one of the most popular dishes in China today is scrambled eggs and tomatoes. So... no cuisine is static.
It's interesting you mentioned the idea of being authentic. I was struck by a line that you quote from a diner at, I believe it was a Mexican cafe in Southern California. And you quote the diner who's saying, I really love this place because it's super authentic. And of course, the section you were writing about was about Mexican cuisine, in which the whole point of the thing is what is authentic when it comes to Mexican food in America. Is it Tex-Mex? Is it California? Is it New Mexican cuisine? Is it the transplants that have come from Sonora, Mexico, or Oaxacan area of Mexico, or wherever? I was struck by the fact that that is just what is authentic.
First of all, the patron was at El Indio in San Diego, which has been doing pretty much the same thing for 70 or 80 years. So, yeah, it's authentic to itself. It's authentic to the kind of Mexican-American food that evolved in San Diego as a subset of what had been regional northern Mexican cuisine until 1848, when the United States took half of Mexico away in the Mexican-American War, and all of a sudden, for everyone north of the Rio Grande, who until yesterday had been Mexican, well, today you're American, with possibly less access to some of the foods that you used to like. And if you're going to make any money selling your food in restaurants, you're going to have to modify it somewhat to fit the tastes of the Anglos. And that was the base from which the various forms of Mexican-American cuisine evolved in America. You know, Tex-Mex is a perfectly legitimate and delicious cuisine. It's different than the food served in northern Mexico today, just as it's different from California Mexican, which evolved from the same beginning in a slightly different direction, or Mexican food in New Mexico, where they grow these remarkable peppers, specifically hatch peppers, that are now used in many of those dishes. Of course, we're now in a period of time where, with different immigration patterns, we're starting to see different Mexican foods from other regions of the country being brought here by immigrants from other regions of the country, such as birria, which is a spicy meat stew first seen in central Mexico and made with goat over a number of years, a variation called birria de res evolved, which was made with beef. And somehow it migrated to Tijuana, where it then was turned into a particularly terrific kind of grilled taco. It jumped the border to Southern California. Now it's crossed the country to the East Coast. You get this incredible taco that's been grilled with the beef and sometimes cheese inside it. And then you dip it like a French dip sandwich into a cup of the original cooking liquid, which is now called consomme. And I got to tell you, it's definitely a death row meal. It's phenomenal.
I just had my first goat birria about 2 weeks ago, as a matter of fact.
Phenomenal, isn't it?
It is. It is awesome. Yeah, it is.
If you had goat, you had it as a plate or as a taco?
I had it as a plate.
Yeah. No.
But I did have a dipping sauce with it.
Yeah, that's how I first had it in Jalisco. We were shooting something, a TV thing, on tequila. And we're on our way to or from a family-owned tequila distillery when we passed this forlorn-looking, almost shack-like building that turned out to be a restaurant that served whatever they were serving that day, and that's what you got. And what we got was birria, and it was unbelievable. Just great. The question, though, to me is, will birria retain this popularity and become part of the Mexican-American menu, or is it a foodie fad of a moment that will not?
I was struck by something in that section where I think it was a Southern California, it may have been the gentleman El Indio, who was talking about chimichangas, and he goes, "What's a chimichanga? Never heard of this." And they, you know, said, "Oh, a burrito? We deep fry it. Okay." And then all of a sudden it's on the menu.
Yeah, that was the original owner. The story was told to him by his daughter. And I think they went through the same process with the California burrito, which is a burrito, I think it's carne asada, with french fries on the inside. Mm. I think someone asked for that and described it, and now it's on the menu. So Mexican-American food, we have this kind of standard menu now that incorporates various types. But it developed in different ways, definitely, in different places.
My guest today is David Page. He's the Emmy Award-winning news producer. He was for NBC and ABC News and then turned to food, I think, when he was a producer at Good Morning America. And he created the Food Network hit Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, and he has a new book out titled Food Americana. It's a mixture of talking with restaurateurs, but also sort of experiencing great experiences, like you're at the Memphis in May barbecue competition with one of the competitors. The very first story of the book is you actually attend the International School of Pizza to learn how to do old school Neapolitan style pizza. What's involved with that?
It is, to put it mildly, far more complicated than people realize. Far more complicated. Tony Gemignani, who's one of the leading lights of pizza in America and the 13-time pizza champion in international competition, runs a pizza-making school that is attended mostly by professionals looking to up their game and by a fair amount of foodies. He allowed me to audit the class. I went out there and found out that the amount of science and technique and and knowledge that is required to really make a good pizza is astounding. Everything from the protein levels of the different flour that you may be using to the kind of oven that you're using. In other words, if you go into your local pizzeria and they've got six different kinds of pizza on the menu with different crusts, and they only have one oven, to put it mildly, they ain't doing it right. Tony's place, he has five or six different ovens. For example, New York pizza needs to be done in a gas-powered deck oven. Neapolitan needs to be done in a wood-fired oven. Each of these produces a different kind of crust. Trying to make a Neapolitan was near impossible. What you have to do after properly stretching and creating the dough and getting it onto your pizza peel, you have to drop it into the oven in one particular place without sliding it, because as you slide it, you burn it. Then you've got to pull the pizza peel. I'm sorry, not pull it out yet. You have to use the pizza peel to turn your crust every few seconds so that you get even charring along the outside, which they call leoparding. It's, you know, leopard spots. But simply turning the pizza, it's not like you make a turning motion. You've got to lift one side of the pizza up and then pull the peel out, and the motion causes it to turn and drop. But if it doesn't drop exactly where it had been, now you're burning part of the crust, the part that's outside the circle where it originally was, because that circle had gotten a little cooler by the presence of the dough on it. So if you don't get right back to the circle, you're burning your crust. You've got to turn it all the way around, then lift it, hold it over the wood fire in a particular way to finish the bottom, and then pull it out. And you have all of 60 to 90 seconds to do this. As I point out in the book, I was not the smart kid in the class.
But yet, and what's interesting about that old school Neapolitan pie is it's supposed to be eaten within a minute or so.
Yeah, Tony says if he delivers a Neapolitan to your table and you're talking and you're talking and you're talking, and within a few minutes you haven't tried the pie, he'll ask his waiter to take it away and he'll make them another, because a Neapolitan degrades incredibly quickly. It's also, surprisingly to many people, it is not what you think of when you think of an American pizza, because it isn't crispy. It's actually intentionally kind of soupy or soggy. And now there are a lot of places doing alleged Neapolitan crispier than it ought to be. But as Tony says, a real Neapolitan, you may love it, you may hate it.
Mm. And what's interesting is, what I found interesting about your book was you combined story of local restaurants doing a food right alongside the chains. And you sort of treat each in its own way. Like, you tell the story of how Taco Bell started, and how when the Taco Bell closed in State College, Pennsylvania, you know, the Penn State students went into mourning, and how when White Castle came west of the Mississippi to Arizona, there were lines down the block. And it's really interesting that you sort of treat both in their own way, but, you know, they're very different ways of doing a food, say like a hamburger or fried chicken or barbecue or whatever is involved.
Chains, by definition, don't have to be Darth Vader. You don't have to hate a chain for delivering, among other things, expected regularity. If you're a fan of McDonald's, it's going to be the same wherever you go. In the case of Taco Bell, A, how does an author not jump on the story of students holding a candlelight vigil for a fast food restaurant? Luckily, I could use that beautiful anecdote to get into a fact that most people don't realize, which is that the spread of Mexican food across the United States was, to a great extent, the result of Taco Bell. And Taco Bell doesn't claim to serve Mexican food, at least these days. They claim they serve Mexican-influenced food. But it was the Taco Bell chain moving eastward from California as it expanded, along with other hamburger chains and such during kind of a golden age of fast food explosion in the U.S. That's what gave millions of Americans their first exposure to something like a taco, which they had never seen before. And that opened the door for Mexican restaurants making Mexican-American food owned by Mexican immigrants or the children of Mexican immigrants. It opened the door to people saying, well, I like that thing I had at Taco Bell. Why don't we try this place? Mm. So it had a really huge influence on the development of Mexican-American cuisine. Something like White Castle is a fascinating story because most people don't realize that White Castle created the fast food hamburger joint as a chain. Now, White Castle chose not to franchise, which is why they were massively eclipsed in size by later competitors such as McDonald's and Burger King. But it was White Castle that created the hamburger assembly line, if you will, that pushed out a lot of burgers of consistent taste and quality quickly. And in doing so, by the way, they kind of rescued the hamburger from its terrible reputation in the 20s. Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, had exposed the meatpacking industry for terribly unsanitary, horrible practices. And since the burger as chopped meat was seen as the worst of the worst, the hamburger was in deep trouble until White Castle intentionally started selling it, A, in such a way that people watched it being made, and B, and probably more importantly, in architectural circumstances that evoked a hospital, stainless steel, white tile. It all screamed sanitation. And that's what kept the hamburger, or allowed the hamburger to bounce back and become, in many respects, the quintessential American food.
You talk about sushi, and you actually begin in a story in Oklahoma at a gas station sushi restaurant in Del City called Ninja Sushi Station.
Well, Ninja Sushi Station is one of those gas station and convenience store setups with the addition of an honest-to-God sushi bar inside, where there is a sushi chef fresh making sushi at your direction and doing very, very well. Now, they have made, as with anything that becomes Americanized, there are concessions made for the tastes of the audience. And with a fair amount of resistance to raw fish in the Del City area, they found, their biggest seller is sushi that they then deep fry. They take the whole sushi roll and drop it in boiling oil, and what could be better than that?
How did you discover a place like this?
Online. I had it in my head. I had heard the expression gas station sushi, which generally means prepackaged prepared sushi sold as a grab and go. But I went online and started looking around, and I found Ninja Sushi Station and a place in Memphis in a gas station. But the place in Memphis, it turns out, had shut down.
One of the things that's really interesting that the book does point out is, you know, you've had these multi-generational restaurants, that some of which you profile in the book, and just the sheer amount of hard work involved. You know, you're talking about somebody like Aaron Franklin, the barbecue superstar now, but who started out, you know, just making a decision to up the quality of the beef in his barbecue, and, you know, the long hours involved, you know, 18 hours on a brisket. And you look at a lot of these restaurateurs, it's hard to imagine that they could sustain this for 30, 40 years, because when they're really doing it the way that makes them a legendary restaurant or a place that people will come and search out and find and have the food, you know, the sheer amount of work to keep that up is so incredible. It's such labor-intensive work.
Well, you're actually seeing the result of that in certainly the Chinese restaurant world, where many parents wanting a better life for their kids than they've had working incessantly to make a few bucks are intentionally pointing their kids away from going into the business. Something similar has happened along the way in the barbecue industry, where the influence and presence of African Americans is an undertold story anyway, but where over the years, a number of African American pitmasters did not want their families following them in the business, because getting up at 3 a.m. to start a fire and working all day and then getting back up to do it again, it seemed to them that their kids deserved better. The fact of the matter is, running a restaurant is an incredibly challenging, difficult task. And unless you really love what you're doing, they call it the hospitality business, and it really is about pleasing people. Unless you really want to do that, it's a hell of an awful way to try to earn a living. Now, unfortunately, and I don't have statistics on this yet, but it's pretty clear to me that it's happened, I believe that the pandemic put a large number of family-owned restaurants, mom and pops, out of business because the money just wasn't coming in and the rent was still due. And that's a shame. I mean, you know, a few minutes ago, I was defending the hamburger chain. I'm far less open to defending the casual dining chain, things like Chili's or Applebee's, which on the one hand present themselves as your neighborhood restaurant at the same time that your decision to go there is killing neighborhood restaurants.
And it's killing them at expense of somebody who maybe hand makes the food to something where it's pulled out of a freezer bag and heated up.
Yeah, these chains are defrosters.
Yeah.
You know, they ain't making it by hand, let me be clear. I just do not like what that is doing to American food.
Now, you left the news business to get into the food business. Had a very successful show that's still running on Food Network. What's next for your production company? Are you working on new ideas for shows?
You know what? I have always, every few years, changed careers. Up to a recent point, I changed my careers within broadcasting. I was an investigative producer. I was a foreign producer. I was a morning show guy. I decided to go with the author thing for a while. I very much enjoy it. It's very new to me. I'd never written a book before, but I'm getting a kick out of it. And I'm going to stay on this side of the lens for a while.
All right. Well, the name of the book is Food Americana. David Page, thanks very much for joining us.
And thanks for having me. I had a great time.
David Page is a television producer and the creator of Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives on the Food Network. And his new book is titled Food Americana, The Remarkable People and Incredible Stories Behind America's Favorite Dishes. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.